Good morning. We return to our Old Testament survey, and today we're looking at the Judges, period. And as I mentioned last week, keep in mind that we are in the survey going at a faster clip than our congregational reading. So we have surpassed where we're at in our congregational readings, and so the survey now will be a preview of what you're going to be reading about in the coming week. So very happy to be together. Earl, can you lead our thoughts in a prayer?
Our Father in heaven, we are grateful to you for every blessing that we enjoy through our support of Jesus. And we are thankful for this opportunity we have to be here this morning in this place. And we pray that you would be with us as we study from your word. Help us to be receptive to the things that are revealed there and use those things to help us serve you more faithfully. In Jesus' name, amen.
So if you would like to update your timeline, there are two parts of the timeline. As you can see, you have a linear line, and then you have the Exodus where they go down into Egypt, illustrated there with the dip of the timeline. And we're finishing here up the first half of the two pages. So the thing that we're going to talk about today is this period called the Judges. And don't think of Judges in the sense of someone sitting on a high bench in a robe, dropping a gavel down and saying guilty. There is an element of that maybe in what they were doing, but mostly they were deliverers in the middle of a crisis. They were crisis leaders. It's like, you know, you have the military, but in time of war, a lot of people come into the military that aren't necessarily in it, and a lot of people get promoted to a high position in the military that wouldn't have otherwise. So in a time of crisis, there is a leadership demand. And so this is a time, these are times of crises, and so a leader would emerge. And so that's what we're going to be talking about today. Now, the Judges period, and really the Judges period covers the book of Judges, but also the first few chapters of the book of 1 Samuel. And there are two reactions you can have to the Judges period, or at least two reactions I have to it. It's very intriguing. Here's a man who goes out to fight a battle, and God says, your army's too big. You got to get it down to just a few hundred from several thousand. You've got this strong man, Samson, you know, who can just whip hundreds of people at a time. You've got this man who asks God to bless him in battle, and he says, I'll sacrifice whatever meets me when I come home, thinking some animal would walk out and meet him, and his daughter does. And then, everybody's favorite, Jael, who is in a tent, and a bad guy comes into the tent, and she gives him something to eat, and he lays down for a nap, and then she takes a tent peg, and she rams it with a hammer through his head. Now, these are lovely stories. Some of the more bizarre stories of the Old Testament are found in the Judges period. And it's sometimes you read this book, and it's not just the stories, it's also the ones that God is using to take leadership and to accomplish things, their character is like, ugh, you just grimace sometimes because their character is controversial, or it puts you off because of certain traits that emerge. And so there are some inspiring characters, but not quite the Moses, the Joshua, and the David that we're used to encountering. And so there is a little bit of grimacing. It's a messy book because some of the people that God is using, they turn around and they sort of mess things up after they have this good period. But it is very revealing because the relationship, again, we're looking at this primer on who God is and the relationship between God and humans. That's what the Old Testament is. It's the primer. I just think when someone doesn't know the Bible and they start studying the Bible and they start encountering the Old Testament, their whole worldview is affected. It is like, oh, yes. You know, it's like our experience with the book of Ecclesiastes. You know, it's just like, oh, yes, that's how life works. And so when you see God interacting with these people in the Old Testament, you're like, yeah, that's how things work. That's how the world works. That's how humans are and so forth. And so though this book is sort of messy in some ways, it is very revealing about the relationship of God and human beings. And that's why it's there. So, very revealing. So let's look at this. Let's survey the Judges period and look at this need for deliverers by first turning our attention to early in the book of Judges, to the second chapter. So turn to Judges 2 with me. Now, what did we say last week? We ended on this really high note last week regarding the conquest. What did we say? What did we see in the commentary of the book of Joshua regarding the generation of Israelites who took the land under Joshua's leadership? What was this generation of Israelites like?
They're maturing.
Yeah, they've really grown and matured in their faith. How were they regarding carrying out God's instructions?
Faithful.
They're generally very faithful, very dedicated. And the book of Joshua ends with the comments that, you know, during the generation of Joshua and those who followed, that the Israel served the Lord faithfully. So the Joshua generation of Israelites is a sterling example of faithfulness to the Lord. And then we come to this. So look at Judges 2, 10 to 14. Dave, can you read that for us? 2, 10 to 14, please.
Both generations also were gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that they had for Israel. And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served Baals, and they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went after other gods from among the gods of the people who were around them and bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger. They abandoned the Lord and served the Baals and the Asheroth. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them over to prisoners, and who proved them, and he sold them into the land of their surrounding enemies so that they could no longer withstand their enemies.
All right, thank you very much. What about this generation? Not faithful. And specifically, what is listed here as the problem? The idolatry worship. And these, by the way, you're getting a video, by the way, this week about the law. And right now, our congregational reading is in the book of Deuteronomy, which is like the reiteration or the second reading and reminder of the law to the new generation that's going to take the land. But Ken and I will have a video and sometime in the next month or so about the people of Canaan. And I'll say something about their idolatry. These are references to the common Canaanite deities, the Baals and the Ashtaroth. And actually, these are umbrella terms. You'll see the term Baal, singular, used, but Baal is sort of a, you know, it's an umbrella term. There could be a lot of gods associated with it. The Baals, okay, and the Asheroth, it's like a host of gods, it really, in a way. And Israel pursues them. And this will be a motif in the Old Testament narrative, in this literature, from here to the very end, almost, at least to the captivity. They will have a period like under David where they're not idolatrous, but before the days of David, they're going to struggle with this. It's going to be worse at certain times than others. Certain times I have periods where they'll get away from it, but they'll be nagged by it all the time. And then after David, they're going to return to this. And Israel will go headlong into it, even their kings, and Judah will go in and out of it. And sometimes their kings will lead them into it and sometimes not. And so this is going to be a really big problem. So we need to understand it. So let's talk about this real quickly here. It's really easy for us to dismiss the Old Testament's record of pagan idolatry and to think that somehow it's almost irrelevant. It might be interesting to read about it, but it's almost irrelevant to us because really you think about it, idol worship across the world's religions is not as common as it used to be. There are some religions that still directly use idols for worship. Hinduism being the main one, probably. Buddhism sort of dabbles in it. You could even say Catholicism indirectly uses idols, okay? But you think about Islam, which dominates a big part of the world, it's completely vehemently against idolatry, okay? And so, in all the forms of Protestantism and all that kind of stuff. And so, really, as a practice, it's not as in vogue as it used to be. But yet it is. Because so many reasons why people worshiped idols, they're the same reasons that are motivating people to do the things they do religiously. So the more things change, what? Right. Sounds like Ecclesiastes, doesn't it? Okay, so here's a short list of why they were attracted to the pagan idols. In spite of the evidence that these idols were untrue, and that God was the Lord, Jehovah, was the God and the only God. And of course, what recent demonstration had they had in that the idols are nothing? What big event proved that the gods are nothing?
All plagues.
That's right. The Egyptian deliverance. All the plagues, everything that happened there showed that the Lord is God and the other ones are false and nothing to him. But they did anyway. So why? Well, I think that part of this is the physical and the tangible. Remember how Paul writes to the Corinthians, we walk by faith, not by sight. This is always a challenge. Remember that this is Israel's first plunging into idolatry. It's because Moses had disappeared on the mountain and had gone days and days and days. And they're not hearing the voice of the Lord. They're not experiencing that direct contact with his intensity. And they're like, make us a God, something we can see. And so that's always an attraction. Also, the allurement of what others have. I just think that it's good to just boil it down to this. No matter how stupid somebody may be in doing something, there's going to be somebody who will want to do it because they're doing it. You know, the old expression of, you know, if your friends jumped off a cliff, you jump off too. You know, we may say that to some young person or something like that. But that's so true. You know, this thing of imitation, there's just an attraction that when we see another human doing something, even if we pull back and say, okay, what's the reason for that? What's the benefit of that? And you conclude, that's completely idiotic. Why I should be doing that? But yet, people are attracted to what other people are doing. It's just something about humans, okay? Again, that's why the Old Testament is so revealing about the nature and the character of humans. Yeah, Earl?
Later, they want to keep because everybody else has.
Yeah, we're going to see that at the very end. I mean, that is a common problem the Israelites living in Canaan will have. They want to be like, do like those Canaanites. I think these last two is where these are very, very relevant. Understand that the Baals and the Ashtaroths were gods oftentimes related to productivity and fertility, especially the Baals. The Baals were storm gods. Now, if you've ever lived in what is called a Mediterranean climate, look here. Rick's not here. He's out. Rick's from a Mediterranean climate, California. But Mediterranean climate means you have cycles of wet weather. In a Mediterranean climate, certain months out of the year, it never rains. Never rains at all. You know, here, it can rain any day of the year. But you can almost set your clock to it in a Mediterranean climate. Certain times of the year, it's not going to rain. And so when the rains do, when the rainy season comes, you really need the rains. And so it is with the Canaanite geography and climate. And so the Baals were gods that people believed in, that if you honored these gods, they would send the rains. And the rains produced the vegetation that then helped with agriculture and helped with livestock and provided water for livestock, and thus everybody prospered. And these were also not just productivity gods, they were also fertility gods. And so if you worship these gods appropriately, then you, your family, and your livestock would all reproduce and have a lot of babies and calves and lambs and everything kids, as in goats, and everything else. So do you see the attraction? In our day, we call it the health and wealth gospel. Serve the Lord and have enough faith and you'll have all the money you can count. More money you can count, put it that way. We all have all the money we can count, but more money than you can count. The health and wealth gospel, it's probably tapered off some. It had its heyday more recently in the 80s and 90s, but there are still people out there preaching it. That if you have enough faith in the Lord, you'll whatever you touch will turn to gold in business or whatever. It's the same thing. Absolutely the same thing. And associated with that, because they're fertility gods, some of the rites, some of the rituals to encourage the gods to bless you with, you know, herds and flocks and babies involve sexual activity. So there was a lot of immorality that was not just allowed, it was even encouraged. And so drunken feasts and sexual immorality, visiting a temple prostitute, this becomes common in the Roman period, in the New Testament period, with some of the Greek gods. But just even some drunken orgies and things such as that, that's what's going on. So now you understand something when God said, okay, enough's enough with Canaan, I'm going to wipe Canaan clean. The iniquity of the Amorites now are full. I'm going to send the Israelites in to drive these people out. Child sacrifice, drunken orgies, you get it? So the Israelites see that belief in these gods will bring them prosperity and it will indulge their fleshly appetites. So they're attracted. And I don't think we read it in the congregational reading, but back in the book of Numbers, there's the incident in the latter part of the book of Numbers called the Baal at Peor incident, where some of the Israelites got caught up with some of the locals in some religious rituals that included sexual morality. And this is where Phinehas goes through and punishes some of them and so forth. And so they're dabbling at this before they even get to Canaan. So now you understand this pull all through these years of serving these gods. And it was a very real problem. Okay? All right, any comments on that or questions? And there are even religions that along the way have encouraged immorality. Okay? You know, communal marriage and things such as that. So, or even probably in our day, it's a lot more highbrow, the idea that, you know, you can still serve God and your moral choices and your sexuality is what you feel that you think it needs to be. And there's nothing wrong with your sexual passions as long as, you know, you're true to your word and you're sincere and honoring God and all that. That's preached today. So, there are actually people who endorse, you know, in religious circles, homosexuality. And it's just the same thing. It really is.
Kind of cultish in a way.
Yeah.
Kind of see how a cult leader could be that physical, tangible person, adornment of what others have. I don't know about that one, but
yeah.
Immorality definitely that goes on.
Yes. I mean, this is, yes.
Desire for earthly success. Maybe they feel like because we've separated ourselves from the world.
Right.
Especially blessed or
something. Right. No, I think you're tapped into something there. I mean, there are plenty of exceptions, but depending on how you define a cult, everybody's got their own definition for it. But there have been a lot of cults where some kind of sexual morality has been associated with it. And especially among the leaders, like the David Koresh thing in Texas. Remember him? So he had all these wives, all these kids. You know, he took all these young wives. So, yeah, I was thinking that too. Mormonism, of course, got rid of that in the late 19th century, but early on, and that's why they were heavily persecuted and went out west is because of their polygamy. And, you know, people in America said, no, that's not right, because it was very, remember our lesson several weeks ago? In the 1800s, America was very dominated by Protestant values. And Protestant values were, you know, evangelical Protestant values were from mostly the Bible. We said, one man, one woman for life. And so that's why Mormonism was so persecuted at first, was mainly because of the polygamy. And they went out west and lived in an area that was no man's land. And eventually they got state. And the big debate about letting Utah become a state had to do with polygamy. We're going to let the polygamists become sort of like a homosexual debate today, isn't it, a little bit? So, and that had a lot to do, I think, with Mormonism dropping the polygamy because they wanted to be accepted into the mainstream of America. So, anyway, that's another whole... See, these things are not irrelevant, are they? They're very relevant. Things don't change, do they? They really don't change. Same issues. Okay, well, let's look here at what takes place. What happens because Israel is unfaithful to God? Well, now we have this thing we call the Judges cycle. So look here at Judges 2. Zachary, can you read verse 16 to 23 for us, please?
Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hand of those who plundered them. Yet they did not listen to their judges, for they poured after other gods and bowed down to them. They soon turned aside from the way in which their fathers had walked, who had obeyed the commandments of the Lord, and they did not do so. Whenever the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge, and he saved them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. But the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning, because of those who afflicted and oppressed them. But whenever the judge died, they turned back and were more corrupt than their fathers, going after other gods, serving them and bowing down to them. They did not drop any of their practices or their stubborn ways. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he said, because this people has transgressed my covenant that I commanded their fathers, and has not obeyed my voice, I will no longer cry out before them any of the nations that Joshua left them and died, in order to test Israel by them, whether they will take care to walk in the way of the Lord as their fathers did or not. So the Lord left those nations, not driving them out quickly, and he did not give them into the hand of Joshua.
All right, thank you very much. So this is what we call the Judges cycle. And it is a cycle, and it is a pattern. You could see some minor variations to it, but this is generally what happens. And this section right here is a preview of the rest of the book. The cycle that's depicted in verses 16 to 23 will repeat itself, okay, in the days of Gideon, in the days of Samson, in the days of Jephthah, the days of Deborah. It just keeps repeating itself over and over and over. So, Israel would fall into sin. They would be unfaithful to God mainly through idolatry and serving these pagan gods. Then they would be oppressed by their enemy. Their enemy nearby would come in and invade and take their crops, take their animals, plunder them, and, you know, really just bring them down to nothing. As a result, the Israelites would cry out to the Lord, oh, what have we done? Please help us, God. What's the irony here? By serving these false gods, what had happened? They suffered. So how well is it working serving Baal and Asherah? It's not, is it? You think they clue into this, right? But they're not. And then a judge would be raised up. God would select some leader. Again, they're leaders. Sometimes they are inspiring the people to repent of their idolatry. In many cases, they are military leaders that are driving the invaders out. And so there are a variety. And again, don't expect a lot out of these judges. Don't expect to be morally and spiritually inspired by all of them. Some of them have their moments, great moments of faith, like Gideon and even Samson. And I say that because Hebrews talks about Samson, so we can say he is, to some extent, at a certain time, an example of faith. But he's a rascal most of the other time. But God has his way. You know, because here's the point. Who's the real deliverer in all this?
God.
It's God. Judges is a good example of driving this point home about the Old Testament. The Old Testament is not just about inspiring great men and women of faith, like your Ruth and your, you know, Ahab, where did that come from? David, sorry, mistake there. Take that back. Yeah. Or anyway, yeah, Ruth, David, Abraham, great people of faith. Okay, and but the real hero in the Old Testament is God. That's it. And Judges, it's like, it really drives that point home. Put your faith in God, not in, you know, a certain judge, because you get disappointed. And so they have a period where they're delivered from their enemy. They get relief from their enemy. And then they have sort of a period of peace and rest where things are okay. And then they begin to go back to the idols and serve the pagan gods. And then it repeats itself all over again. Let me throw three points out, and then I'm going to let you see what you think, because I'm curious, because this is very revealing, this cycle is, when you look at the big picture. The Judges cycle shows three things here, just to get the ball rolling. It shows that Israel often forgot the pain of disobedience. A lot of people get very filled with faith when they face the pain of their disobedience. But then once the pain of their disobedience fades, so does their faith. And that's what happened with Israel. And understand that these cycles aren't happening with the same people. There might be some people who are living during this cycle who experience as part of the other cycle, but sometimes they're many years apart, and maybe even a generation or two or three apart. But that's the point that we're seeing in the big picture, is that there's a cycle. And so you have this thing of the problem of Christ's obedience. Oh, God, we're sorry. We'll do the right thing now. See how human this is? I don't want to say human nature, because that leaves the impression that, you know, a Calvinistic impression that we're sort of destined to have to act this way. But it's human in the sense of this is how humans act. Shouldn't, and they can do better, but this is how we act. You know, the problem of Christ's obedience. And then it also shows the need for help. They needed these deliverers. They needed these judges to come in and make things better, or help make things better. And so it shows the need for godly leadership. And we'll elaborate on that more later when we get to Judges 21-25. But that just, this is a little note there. Well, when you look at this cycle, look at the big picture here. What does this cycle teach us about God, about people, and about the relationship of God and humans? What comes to your mind?
Long-suffering.
He is, isn't he? I mean, he put up with cycle after cycle after cycle. Very patient.
God is our protector. He protects us when we disobey. Right. The protection's gone, and that's why we're oppressed.
Right. The blessings and the protection are with God, not with these other idols and gods. Exactly.
People are fickle.
Yeah.
Fickle of humans. Fickleality of humans. Fickleness of humans, whatever it's called. Yeah. And, think about what the New Testament says about the Old Testament. The main message the New Testament has about the Old Testament is that it points us to Christ. Okay? The second one is, it's in the category of it makes us wise to salvation, such as 2 Timothy 3, or the Romans statement, so that we learn from the examples. In the 1 Corinthians 10 statement, we learn from the examples. And this is a constant lesson from the Old Testament, is if we want to be the people of God, we got to watch for being fickle. Well, what's your definition of that? I think we all know what that means, but elaborate on that, Earl. Fickle.
One minute you're all in. I want to do this. This is the right thing to do. And 30 minutes. Well, maybe not 30. Maybe 30 minutes later, you flip 180 degrees out. And you're willing to do something 30 minutes ago. You've already done.
Could be 30 minutes, 30 hours, or 30 days. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way to put it. All in and then all out. Yeah.
Not handling success very well.
Ooh, if things are going well, you don't have this ability to stick on the right path. Yeah. You can't handle the good days. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's so true.
Yeah. To me, there's a message about deliverance. God is the God of deliverance. all throughout the Old, and then he'll point us to Christ, who will be our deliverer. Right. So to me, there's a real strong message for people.
There is a messianic element to this cycle in that what saves the day is the raising up of a deliverer. And that's very messianic. Yeah. And also see how that all this that we're describing reminds us of the Israelites in the wilderness, doesn't it? And then that's why we say that generation of Joshua was really sterling. You don't see this in them, generally. You see sin, but you don't see this kind of pattern. Is that...
As far as like human nature commentary, peace can be more spiritually dangerous to suffering.
Yeah. Very interesting subject to study, persecution. Because you think about in the 2,000-year history of, quote, Christianity, persecution has not been constant and pervasive. It doesn't work as well as peace and prosperity. That's what I think. That's the real dangerous times. You had another follow-up.
Yeah, one time going to a gospel meeting, one of the preachers that had heard had talked about this cycle, and his point of view is that, and I think you might well be right, is that it's not so much a cycle as it's a downward spiral. Because they didn't listen to the judges. And they poured after other gods. Verse 19, whenever the judge, they turned back and were more corrupt than their fathers. Yeah. So it's, he described it as a toilet bowl. And there's continually going down farther. Right. It's like there is this like nature to it, but they never get back to where they were last time.
That's a great point. It really is. It's going around in a circle, but it gets lower. Yeah.
And that, like a downward spiral, at the end of the book, they leave out the crying of the Lord and his heart is out.
Yeah, that's a great way. I mean, here the Lord is cleansing Canaan to replace them with a group of people that just become like them. And that's why the Lord allows these pockets to stay to be a test. As it talks about at the end of the last couple of verses of chapter 2. You can also say about the downward spiral that Israel really doesn't, I don't think, completely pull out of it. You might could argue Saul's kingdom, but you could argue David's kingdom. And then after David, at the end of Solomon's years, he starts idolatry. And then Israel splits, and both Israel and Judah have trouble with idolatry. But even in periods when Judah would repent and cleanse things, several places like in the 2 Kings, it says, but yet the people kept worshiping on the high places. So they would have a period of a king that would come in and have a renewal and a restoration. But then there would be elements of that idolatry that would remain. And they never quite got it back to square one with God. And it eventually ended up in the Babylonian captivity. They were completely wiped out. So again, it's like that, you know, cycle, you know, idolatry turned back to the Lord with a good king. Idolatry turned back to the Lord, but yet at the same time, it kept descending. So great. Thank you so much. I just really appreciate how all of you are thinking in terms of survey. You're thinking the broad picture of the Old Testament, and that's what a survey does for us. And then you go in and you study a particular book like 2 Kings, and you're able to hang all those details on all these big nails that we're nailing to the wall here. So, excellent. You're doing a great job. I don't know how I'm doing today, but you're doing a great job. Okay, I'll try to rise to the occasion. So, this is in a way, and we'll go back to Elaine's point about the need for leadership to sort of step in and save the day. And there is another underlying storyline here, and that is there is building the need for a permanent leader for all of Israel, not a crisis leader, but a permanent one. So you sort of see that building, don't you? And the truth is that God has an eventual plan, Problem is, the Israelites come up with a plan too. It's not a good one. So let's look at this move to a king. Look at the end of Judges, by the way, and this is the point that we're looking at. Judges 21:25. What does that say, Gary? The last verse of Judges 21:25.
In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes.
All right, the fact that the scriptures pair these two statements together, tell us what? Look at them individually and then look at them together. They need a ruler. Now, this is the scriptural commentary. There was this Wild West kind of atmosphere. People just, you know, there was no law kind of thing. Well, there was a law, wasn't there? There was a priesthood, wasn't there? There was a reminder that they had a king among them, right? What was the physical reminder among them that there was a ruler among them? The tabernacle. In the holy place, in the most holy place, where the presence of God hovered over the mercy seat of the ark, just like a king sitting on a throne. But there was no king in another fashion, and everybody did whatever was right. So what we're seeing here is this atmosphere that a lack of leadership is connected to this wild, chaotic atmosphere. So, go over with me to 1 Samuel chapter 8. Samuel is actually a judge. He tends to be one of these like long-term judges, like all his life. And he tends to be judging not in the military sense, but in the guidance sense. He's trying to guide them. He goes and visits different parts of Israel to guide them in the will of the Lord. But he's depicted as a judge. Okay, not like Gideon, like a military judge, or a fighter like Samson, but he is a judge. And look what happens here. 1 Samuel chapter 8. Daryl, can you read verse 4 to 9? 1 Samuel 8, 4 through 9.
Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. And they said to him, "Behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations." But the thing was displeasing in the sight of Samuel, and they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you. For they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me for being king over them. Like all the deeds which they have done since the day that I brought them up from Egypt, even to this day, in that they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now then, listen to their voice. However, you shall solemnly warn them and tell them of the procedure of the king who will reign over them."
All right, thank you. So, what's motivating them, according to the text, asking for a king?
You want to be like the other nations?
What that is telling the Lord is that your arrangement for us is not working. We have a better one. We want to be like those nations around us. And Samuel is very upset there. And how does the Lord respond to Samuel? Samuel is also a prophet. The Lord speaks to Samuel from the time he was a boy. And he is a prophet of God too. And so what does he tell the prophet, Judge Samuel, regarding the people's request? The what?
Heed their voice.
Okay, he basically tells them to do what he had asked to do. We'll get that in a second. Before that, he said,
"It's not that they've rejected you, they've rejected me."
So Samuel feels like he somehow failed. They're rejecting him. And God's saying, the basis of this is they're rejecting me. Now, this takes a little dexterity. Pull back again, big picture. Ultimately, in the plan of God, there is a king in God's plan. How do we know that? Ultimately, big picture. God is king. And he'll give us a king through whom? The king. Through Jesus the Christ. The Christ means anointed one, which is a kingly reference. Kings were anointed into their office. So God includes a king in his plan. And to get to King Jesus, who was one of the critical ancestors of Jesus to help us know who the Messiah would be. He's the son of Abraham and also the son of David. Most commonly, he's referred to as the son of David in the New Testament, as far as, you know, Old Testament references. And David was king. And he's to be the king like David. He's to be this great shepherd king and so forth. And so there is a king involved in God's plan. But see how that this, at this time, this way, is off. All along the way, God has provided what the people needed and what he wanted them to have. Whose idea was the king right here? To have a king. Whose idea was it? It was the people. So you got, it's sort of like Moses trying to deliver the Israelites when he's 40. Is there anything wrong with that plan? As far as the basic plan? No. It's timing in person. It's timing, right? It's not God's timing. So this is not God's timing. It's also not the motivation. It's to be like the nations around them. That's really what they want to be like. God's trying to make them a separate people, right? In more ways than one. So there will be a king in the plan of God, because we'll see David come along later, and he's called a man what? After God's own heart. I mean, this is very much in keeping with God's will to provide David as a king. And when David is king, God picks him and picks him when he wants to pick him. And he picks a very unlikely candidate too, by the way, doesn't he? But this approach is wrong. It's coming from the people. It's coming out of the wrong motivation. And so they're not wanting a king to lead them to serve God. Based on what God says right here in this text, they want a king to replace him. So it's not the idea of the king that's the problem so much as how this all goes down. Yes?
I just look at that phrase in Judges 21, 25. It like, struck me. It's like everyone did what was right in his own eyes because there was no king in Israel. The inference is when they do have a king, they're going to do what's right in the king's eyes. Would you see that throughout the history of the kings?
Who would look at it?
Was he ever good?
Yeah.
They didn't follow, it's like having a king was not going to make them follow God, they were going to follow the king.
Right. I mean, well, that statement is loaded. There are a lot of layers to it, and that's one, because starting here in verse 10 in this reading we just had onward, Samuel, by the Lord's direction, tells the people, well, this is what your king's going to be like. And basically, the king is going to be a king. He's going to squeeze you. He's going to dominate you. Okay, he's not going to be what you think he's going to be. Like, he's going to be like every other human leader, just about it. He's going to do what they all do. He's going to be after number one. And that's what happens here. And Zachary's right. So many of their kings will lead them in the wrong direction all through their history. So that's not an automatic fix. And even that statement, there was no king in Israel, everybody did what was right in his own eyes. What's Israel doing right here? What's right in their eyes? The problem was Israel didn't recognize the king they had. That was the problem. And so this is not going to be a king that will help them serve God, but rather to go in a direction away from God. And this is going to be the classic case of people getting exactly what they asked for. God's going to select a king for them, and he's going to end up being a very human king. Even though God has Samuel selected in his own process through, I'm sorry, God has Saul selected through his own process through Samuel, Saul's going to be the first king, and though Saul has a good start, Saul's going to end up being a very human king. He's going to be very disobedient to God, and he's going to be very self-willed and stubborn and rebellious and everything else eventually. And so they're going to get a human version of king because that's what they asked for. And then God's going to come in and pick his king. Okay, thank you so much.